Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for our time together this morning. As we look at wisdom literature together, we pray that you would give us wisdom. Help us to see the different things that are going on here. Help us to appreciate your word. Help us to see where this fits within the story, that we might understand more of what it is you're saying to us. Amen. So as I say, week 7, wisdom literature. You've seen that title, Living as God's Covenant People. So this is probably one of the easiest places as we go through to kind of lose track of the storyline and lose track of the forward motion that we've been going through, because obviously we're stepping out of the historical narrative now, and we're coming to this stuff called wisdom literature. Okay, so in our Bibles, wisdom literature is that stuff that starts in Job and ends in Songs of Songs, that sits between the history and the prophets. Okay? So that's where we find it. It's that big bit in the middle. Okay? We get to the end of the history, we get to the end of Esther, and then we turn to Job, and we read the first few lines of Job. If you were reading through the Bible in a year, we get to the end of Esther, and we read through the first few lines of Job, and the first two chapters perhaps think, okay, we're still dealing with history here, and then suddenly we're into poetry, into a very different feel, and into different literature. Okay, so that's how we experience it as we read through. What is wisdom literature? It is not history and it's not prophecy. That's not just a facetious definition. It is saying it isn't those things. It's not law either. Okay, so we see this particularly when we come to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs doesn't function like a law book for us, in the way that it's not filled with thou shalt and thou shalt nots. It is filled with instruction, but instruction is not quite the same as law, and we'll see that as we come through. Okay, so it's not history or prophecy or law, it is something else. I think the easiest way, and you can't just say, oh, it's poetry, because it's not all poetry, or it's this, or it's that. Literary forms vary. So I think the easiest way of categorising it is to say it's a set of literature, varied literature, which is asking the question, what does it mean to live for God today? What does it mean to live for God today? What is it actually like to live as one of God's people, whether that's in the Promised Land, during the exile, or afterwards? Now, we already know that there's other books that are answering that question as well. We've seen that. But that's the sort of particular issue that's being answered. And what does true wisdom look like? Okay? And the big theme that comes through all the books, even though it's only explicit in some of them, is this idea of the fear of the Lord. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And how do we relate to God? Okay? So that's the whole sort of thing. And then obviously, the reason that's a slightly vague definition is that as we get into the books, and this is what we'll look at today, and we'll spend most of our time, I think, in the book of Psalms and in the book of Proverbs. We will see if we get to much on the others. I'd like to get to Job, but I'm not too worried if we don't get to too much of Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs and Lamentations. As we'll see, they're many and varied in terms of what they are. Okay, so let's have a look at. Is that all right so far? So let's have a look at the book of Psalms. Worth having that open, because we will flick through a few Psalms as we go. Page 448. I mean, Psalms has got to be the easiest book in the Bible to find, isn't it? Really, it's big. It's back in the middle. It's a good chance you'll turn to it. If you flick through, there's a good chance you'll find yourself somewhere in the book of Psalms. So I've described the book of Psalms as a song book and a prayer book. Some of these, some of the Psalms have musical notations for the flutes or with stringed instruments according to Sheminith or etc. Now, that suggests that at least some of the Psalms were sung. It is usually assumed that they are all songs. Okay, and I don't think that's unreasonable. Obviously for us, because you've translated from Hebrew to English, and because Hebrew and English poetry works very differently, for us to sing them, we tend to need to set them to music. And let's be honest, for some psalms that works really well, and for some psalms there still aren't really that good settings. Okay, so we're all very happy to sing the Lord's My Shepherd in both versions because that works very well. And there's a nice version of Psalm 1 that I thought did we ever try that? Okay, that we can use. There are some other ones, but some of them they aren't currently in modern songs that are functional to sing effectively. But that's how we have to use them. So for us, and you, I think this is a book that we sing and a book that we read because it is scripture. So it is teaching us about God. And so it's good for singing, good for reading. First thing I've put there is how it was written, because that's sort of quite interesting. I mean, you can see evidence throughout Israel's history for responding to God in song. I've just given you some examples from fairly early on. So Exodus 15, the song of Miriam, that is. Judges 5, 1 Samuel 2, that's the song of Hannah. So there's points in the narrative where the narrative stops for a song and tells us that this is what the Israelites sang, or this is what Hannah sang, or this is what was sung at the time. Even scholars who would be sceptical about how old most of the Old Testament are tend to be fairly accepting of the songs as being old and reaching the long way back. For whatever reason, some of that's presuppositional, but I think that suggests that everyone really agrees that Israel's songs, and therefore some of the Psalms, no doubt, have a long history. Because they are songs, and therefore we presume that they were used at various times, it's a good chance that their usage varied a bit over the years, and that what we've got is a final collection of them as edited and finished, okay? Which includes earlier material, which includes some earlier material that is exactly the same as it was when it first started, but it's entirely possible that there's a little bit of editing that's gone on, because that's what happens with something that's a living song that you're singing all the time. Or there's a verse added to deal with the Exodus or that kind of thing. So that's all fine. And what we can see, just by the way the Psalms are structured, is that there's a collection coming together. So I've given you the list. There's Davidic collections, Psalms of David. There's some to Asaph, some of the Korahites. There's the Song of Ascents, and there's obviously a praise collection. 146 to 150 is the most obvious.
James, can I just ask? I've probably been told this before, but what makes the Psalms of Ascents the Psalms of Ascents?
The fact that we're told they are. Well, we are assuming that they were a set of psalms to be said by pilgrims on the way to Jerusalem. That's the most likely explanation. So you always go up to Jerusalem because it's on a hill, and you tend to come up from, well, either the Jericho direction, in which case you write down at the bottom and you go up the hill. But so you ascend, and of course you ascend towards Zion, towards the mountain. So. Again, the Song of Ascents, I think most people would say look post-exilic. That is, they look like some things that's been put together after the exile. They might well include some earlier material, but that seems to be how they function now. So that's probably an example where it looks like you've perhaps deliberately got together some earlier material, put a set of songs together with some. You know, some things that have been in use by people, because of course some of these anonymous songs are anonymous for precisely the same reason that some of our songs are anonymous, because they're just old. No one quite knows where they came from, but you know, that's like the old folk tunes, isn't it, that people aren't quite sure where it came from and who wrote it, but it's, you know, those tunes that Wesley and others wrote hymns to, the tunes were just tunes. So I think there's something of that. And obviously it's after the exile when the final collection is put together, because you can see there's post-exilic material in there. But taking some stuff from David, some stuff that's been in use. And there's clearly some deliberate placement going on. So the book is clearly put together quite carefully. We read Psalm 1. That is not accidental in its placement. Okay, that has clearly been put at the beginning to help you to see what you're doing when you read the book of Psalms. Okay, you're reflecting on the two ways of the righteous and the wicked. Okay, it's one of the things that puts wisdom and how to live right front and center in the Psalms. Because the first psalm says, look, this is what it's about. And then again, you know, then you can see it in Psalms 3 and 4, that there's a sort of a morning prayer and an evening prayer, sort of two very similar psalms that have been placed together. So there's clearly deliberate placement. Some of it's really obvious to us. Some of it's less obvious to us. And some of it is probably the fact that, you know, when they were being collected, these 10 or 12 psalms had always been in this order, and there wasn't any real reason to change it. So they left them because they came as a set. You know, that's all kind of saying that this is very carefully curated and carefully collected. So, you know, an analogy would be one of those poetry collections that people like Quilla Q did back in the days, where it's carefully curated, but it's not written the poems. They're all poems from long ago, or not so long ago, but they've been put in a structure. A structure has been put on them to enable you to appreciate them better. And obviously then in that case the structure is chronological. Which means you start with a really hard to read 15th century English stuff where you've got to puzzle over the words, and the one that sticks in my mind has got the only bit that sticks in my mind is the bit about now sing cuckoo. Remember that one? Is that one really early one? You must have had to read some of those things. Anyway, I digress. So that's how the Psalms came together. So you do get what that means for us. I think is that it's not always really obvious to us why Psalm 4 is followed by Psalm 5. Okay, so you don't get a clean set of praise psalms, then lament psalms, then confession psalms. Just, I mean, it's not as clean a structure as that, because it's come together, and things that have come into the book have come with their own internal structures, like the Psalms of Ascent, that you have to leave them as they are. Make sense?
So it's not like a hymn of ascent or
great to the church here. No. So but there's a structure. Look, it's like a lot of the Bible, isn't it? There's a structure, but it's not the one we'd like there to be, that makes it easier for us to fit into our thing. I think you can argue that there is a progression. So, you know, the post-exilic stuff, the later stuff, tends to be towards the back end, okay? On the whole, not exclusively, on the whole. And some would argue, and I think there's something in this, that that as you move through the Psalms, they kind of get more sort of eschatological. That is, well, we've seen it, haven't we? Early in Israel's history, the hope for a king is very much a king like David, a king like Solomon, a physical king who will lead Israel. As Israel's history progresses, as you get towards the exile, as you come back from exile, well, that hope for a king becomes tied up much more with a hope that goes beyond a human king and goes beyond what a human king might be able to do. So then the hope for kingship is much more about what God might do in the future. You know, what will happen when God returns on the day of the Lord. So there's a more eschatological looking to the future sense of kingship. I think there's probably something in that. I mean, I think, you know, I don't make too much of it, but I think there is a sense of progression, okay? Just that, about the end, about the future, about what will come, about when. And for us, you see, eschatology is purely about when Christ returns, because everything else has happened. If you're talking about eschatology, the future in before Christ, you're talking about the day of the Lord, okay? Which many in Israel expected to be a single day, John the Baptist seems to have that expectation, doesn't he? If you remember, John the Baptist talks about Jesus. He talks about one who's coming with a winnowing fork in his hand, who will baptize with fire. So John's expectations, one of the reasons why he seems to struggle with Jesus, but asks the question later about who are you, is because he's expecting Jesus' ministry to be the day of the Lord, which will be a day of judgment and salvation. Okay. Now, of course, Jesus' coming is a day of judgment and salvation, but there's a two-stage, there's a now and not yet to it. Okay. If you look from the Old Testament towards that, it's like looking at that range of mountains, and the two mountains are like that, and they look like they're very close together. They're actually miles apart, but of course, when you look from your perspective down below, they're next to each other, aren't they? So you're looking for the coming king. To be honest, that sort of sense of the now, not yet, and looking, particularly when we're in the Old Testament, that sense that they're seeing two events. We know the two events, Jesus' first and second coming, but they're seeing the two events as one event or as two closely linked events because of their perspective. It's a really helpful way of understanding why prophecy works the way it does. And why we end up saying, well, that's been fulfilled, but we're still waiting for that. And one can be in one verse and one can be in the next. Because it's looking at that mountain range. And obviously it's only when you get in the mountains that you realise that second mountain you've got to climb is quite a lot further away than you thought. You've got to go all the way down before you can go back up again. Does that answer the question? Okay. But that's probably quite a helpful way to think about it. Okay. I always spell Psalms. There's always, if I ever write anything about the Psalms, there'll always be a number of times when I spell Psalms incorrectly. Slams. Right. Reading the Psalms. Okay. Remember what we said about parallelism? What's parallelism? Yeah. Or echoes, develops. Yeah, So, classic. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. Now, those are three obviously parallel statements. But, like a lot of Hebrew parallelism, you do also have progression there, don't you? There is a walking, a standing, and sitting. Okay? I've preached that psalm and said, look, there is something about... You might accidentally walk with someone. Stopping and standing is a bit more deliberate. And if you decide to sit down there, that's more deliberate again. And I think that's fine. I think that's how parallelism works. It's not fundamental. It's fundamentally one idea. Don't hang around with the sinners. But you've got that development with it. Now, just the most obvious thing, and we've said this already, is that's not how we tend to do poetry. It just isn't. Okay? So we have to get ahead. We just have to appreciate that's how it works differently. Okay? So what that means also is that sometimes, positively, it means that if you can't understand the line, read the next one. It also means that we have to be careful of getting too excited about slight differences in words used that might be merely poetic license. Just mean. So, Psalm 6, verse 1. O Lord, rebuke me not in your anger, nor discipline me in your wrath. Do we really need to make a big distinction there between God's anger and his wrath? No. Do we need to make a big distinction between his being rebuked and disciplined? Do they not essentially amount to the same thing? Yes, of course they do. That's a fairly synonymous parallelism. Okay, so beware. You've all read the stuff which says, "Oh well, this word here has this very special meaning, and therefore X, Y, and Z." Should be a little bit careful with that kind of thing. Words mean what they mean because they're in the context they're in. Words generally can't bear the weight of all the meaning that they might have, independent of where you read them in a sentence. That makes sense. I do, this is for you, this, all this literature stuff. I added extra in.
Yeah, good. I'm pleased.
Yeah. But that's quite an important principle, isn't it? That a word means what it means in its context. Just to be aware of that. That's just how you read it and how you appreciate it as well. And look, if you read them, you just get into it. It's like reading any poetry. You, once you read enough of it, you get into the form, and it, and then you appreciate it, even though it's initially somewhat alien. Rhythm and metre. Oh, man, people get very, very excited about trying to find particular metre in Hebrew poetry. And I've never read anything that's been terribly persuasive. Certainly not persuasive enough that someone could say, oh, well, that someone would be able to say with absolute confidence, oh, well, because this metre is three and two or three and three, there's a word missing here. It's just not that regular. It's not how it works. Yeah, but we don't really know how that, and our problem is we don't know any Hebrew tunes from 1000 BC, so we don't know how their musical structures worked, so we can't assume that meter had to work in a we can't assume that it was the dum 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 dum, which is how we do it. Yeah, or slightly variations on the theme. But that's how we do meter, isn't it? It's stress and non-stress, or however you do it. It's basically feet, iams, or whatever. So we just have to be a bit careful with that. Obviously, if you know, when we're trying to sing it, we have to put some meter on it. We have to make it singable. And when you're translating it, you try and make it scan. But we just have to be careful and accept the fact that we don't have. It would be lovely to have access to the Sheminith, and I've always fancied knowing what the tune According to the Lilies sounded like. But this sign of heaven, I don't think we're going to be able to restructure that. And look, you know, don't forget, Jerusalem and Israel is far enough east. They're not Europeans. Just mean, not necessarily. You know, if you were thinking about musical structures, you'd probably be better off starting in Persia than in Spain or Italy, in terms of how it works.
It's only very probable, isn't it, that the people singing in synagogues today are singing similar tunes. But
it's not even probable. No, there's too much of a gap. There's no continuity from the first century to the 20th in terms of what's sung in synagogues. That's your problem.
What about the traditional sort of Yiddish stuff?
Right, I'm slightly into territory I only know a little bit about, but my understanding is that there's a lot of cultural recovery work to understand what it means to be Jewish done in the 18th and 19th centuries. And therefore, if you're doing cultural recovery work, it's not always possible to know exactly what you are recovering, aren't you? And you're trying to work out, and you're making assumptions. So, you know, I think just need to be a bit cautious about the continuity there, because there's a lot of breaks, there's a lot of breaches in the system, there's a lot of scattering, and therefore whether we've actually really got access to what it actually, how it was sung, is and yes, but that assumes that there's always a line of grandparents who were doing the singing that you could pick it up from, and also assumes that those forms would remain pure and unaffected by the local culture, which is very unlikely. Because that's just not how, that's not what happens with songs, is it? So even down to the choice of instruments, I'm very happy to be corrected on any of this, because I'm in non-expert territory, as in so many things. But even down to the choice of it, your access for instruments will change what you sing, won't it? Because it has to, and it'll change the keys you sing in. and ultimately change, and then, you know, even down to stupid stuff like this is limits of knowledge now. You know, if you've got a piano, you can get it to do a four beat, it'll the note will reverberate for four beats. If you've got an organ, it'll reverberate for eight. Well, that changes how you sing stuff. I mean, we know that in there, don't we? You know, it takes longer to sing stuff with an organ. It's layman's way of expressing it. It does, doesn't it? It always does.
Yeah,
so it just takes longer to sing. You can't whack through a praise song on an organ, can you?
Not very easily,
because there's too much. You've got one note. You know, one note hasn't finished before you start the next. So that's just an illustration. Do you want to please come and help me out here? Rescue me.
Archaeologically, it is rubbish. You can't recover stuff. If you've not got a recording of some audio, the best you can get is something written down. And notation, for all that's really useful, is rubbish at saying something else it sounds like. If you find an instrument, you know roughly what kind of pitches they have. That's not all the same. So, if I'm really old recorders, that's at least the same basic scale, which is exciting. That's the best you get. So, in terms of how you put those together and what the tune sounds like or looks like or what they're actually meant to, it's a complete guess.
It's an educated guess at times, isn't it?
At times, but you're going a long way.
Yeah.
Because you can do a lot more instrument, basically.
Yeah.
So even if you've got the instrument, if you've got some knobs, it doesn't tell you what you could do with it or what they were doing with it.
Yeah.
And your ears change a lot culturally. So if you go away and listen to a load of experimental jazz, your ears get happy with a lot more things than they were 6 months ago.
Please be clear, we're not advocating listening to experimental jazz.
Thank you.
But it changes what you have to listen to then, and what you're happy to sing yourself a little bit. So if the culture around you is singing something a certain way, it does change your ears a bit. Unless you're totally anti everyone else's music, you stick to your own purely for a thousand years,
which is, it's difficult to do.
Yeah.
It's really, what's really interesting here is that, you know, why did God give us words? Because they're much better at staying the same. Because once something is recorded, written down, it doesn't, it stays. Yeah, whereas how we sing things changes. So it's quite an important principle, isn't it? You know, why did God communicate with us in words? Because words have a certain property of permanence that is not the same about even recordings. Because, you know, in 50 years we won't be able to access the MP3s or whatever because the Windows 27 will have decided we don't need those anymore. Vinyl will still be able to play. Yeah, well, yeah, because it's not electronic, is it? Yeah. Well, yeah. But it is interesting, again, side aside, but there are periods of Egyptian history that we know more because they chisel stuff into stone than some of the periods where they start using paper, well, or papyrus, rather. The papyrus goes missing, it degrades. So we're almost better sometimes with some of the earlier stuff because it's actually... It's chiseled, or some of the sort of Sumerian tablets that are clay tablets that have ended up being physically preserved. They're actually preserved better than a bit of paper. Something to be said for that. Just hit them against the table. Oh, no, it's broken. Oh, and then that. Get another one. There's another one here. Use that. This feels a little off topic. This is quite an important discussion, isn't it? Because actually, the Psalms do cause us to ask the question of how do we sing to God? So I've got no problem with sort of, you know, recognizing that there may be some level of continuity possibly between what's sung now and what's sung then, but just with that caution that it's really, really hard to structure. And anyway, unless we could... Well, here's the thing. If we found a recording somehow of how the Psalms were sung in the temple, in the, let's go really authentic, in the 10th century. So David's written a couple of these Psalms, and next week it's performed in the temple, and we got a recording to it. We still wouldn't be able to sing that anyway, because it's in Hebrew. And if you translate that to English, it definitely won't work according to the same tune. So you'd have to do it differently anyway. So the importance is to preserve the words and find a way of reading them that means we can understand them, and singing them that makes sense to us, makes them memorable, preserves them. So, you know, I'm always happy to sing songs that are based on psalms, but I would always distinguish quite sharply between a song based on a psalm and singing a psalm. Yes, but very, very slowly compared to music. So if you take, for example, the 1662 prayer book, which is based on the same prayer book of 1559, then there are about two words that you need to change because their meaning has changed.
Cool.
Yeah, you need to change indifferent to impartial. Although you still know what indifferent means in the context, it generally, that's about the one. Fine, the these and thous, okay, but if you read through it, the sentences, look, they don't really do full stops as often. They must have been more expensive because there's not enough of them. The sentence structure is different, but it's recognisably English. And the meaning has not fundamentally changed. Even with the AV, you get the odd thing, don't you? So sometimes there's use of the word naughty, which in modern language has become a sort of a very gentle, sort of, you know, jokey word, hasn't it, really? If you say someone, oh, you naughty boy, it's generally not used in the sense it was originally used in. Well, fine, you have to use a different word, but you can still understand what's meant by the original author in that translation, and you've got access to the Greek. So, yeah, they do change, but they're very slow moving. So you can always recover the changes. And you've got a continuous record of... See, what we've got with the Old Testament is not only we've got the Masoretic text, the one that we use, the Hebrew, we've also got a load of versions. So we've got Greek translation, LXX, whatever it's called, Septuagint. Okay, we've got Syriac versions, we've got a Latin, some old Latin, the Vulgate, and various other ones over the years. So you've got access not just to the Hebrew, but also to how it's been translated into various languages, which is quite a useful reference sometimes when it comes to sort of just checks and balances on what did this mean? You know, what did the Greeks think it meant? You know, it comes to the New Testament, you've got plenty of Greek fathers who spoke Greek who tell you what they thought the passage meant. Well, they're a pretty good witness, you know, native Greek speakers to understand what the words meant. So, because it's slow moving, you can trace it. And because, of course, these words are, things are written down and therefore tend to survive, or enough of them tend to survive, you can tend to track that. It does mean that every few years you've got to sort of update your Bible translations. I think that's right, just to make sure that you're using language which is easier. But the biggest changes between the 16th century and now, I would say, are, apart from the these and thous, which actually take you about 2 days to get used to, and then you're fine, when people are reading the these and thous and getting confused, it's not the these and thous that are confusing, it's the sentence structure. It's the long sentences. So we tend to, in English, to use shorter sentences. Well, I don't. I try and string them out as long as possible, but normally use shorter sentences.
Could I ask, what's the significance of
Sila? No one's quite sure, which is why it's untranslated. No one's really quite sure. We think it's probably a kind of a sort of, what does it say on the footnote? Yeah, this is a classic. If you want, you know, like in the Old Testament, if you want the bit where they're not quite sure what to call it, you get miscellaneous laws or miscellaneous greetings. Okay, the equivalent in the Psalms is this. The meaning of the Hebrew word "salah," used frequently in the Psalms, is uncertain. And here's the key one. It may be a musical or liturgical direction.
Which is copyright or photocopy.
That's what it is. Yeah. So you might as well say, look, it may be a musical or liturgical direction. You're basically saying, we don't know. It seems to come at the end of verses, but usually not neatly. So take an example that, you know, Psalm 3's got three of them, and that, oh, you think, but if you look at it, this, as we read that, that looks like four verses, four stanzas, I should say. Let's use stanzas, because we're going to get confused if we use verses. There's four stanzas there, 1 to 2, 3 to 4, 5 to 6, 7 to 8. 5 to 6 is missing a cella. Okay? And then read Psalm 4, first stanza, verses 2 and 3, fine. Verses 3 and 4, fine. Second stanza, but then verses 5, 6, 7 and 8, there's no cellas. What's going on? So it's not neat. It doesn't make it easy for us to... So what we tend to do is we don't tend to read it out when we read the Psalms out because we're just not sure what it means. Go on.
I just wanted to think about music.
Might do.
I think if we
treat it as a brief pause, because obviously if you have to say it, it's a brief pause, isn't it? Let's think. How do we think about this biblically? We've clearly got a word here which is, in God's providence, untranslatable. Okay, and therefore exists in our versions untranslated. So what do you do when you read something? It causes you to stop and pause. So that's as good as anything to do with it. And it looks sometimes like it's marking the end of a stanza. But it's not, the use of it is not as consistent as that to be able to say, all right, yeah, you always use it like this. So that's as good as anything. But just let's acknowledge, we really don't know what it means.
You know, in the Psalms, if we're reading it, I wouldn't tend to read the heading.
Yeah.
But I would read the Choir Master,
yeah.
Strings and instruments. But when we sing a song on Sunday morning, we don't get a steady Celtic feel.
No. Okay. I think it is good to read those. The bits in capitals are part of the text. Okay. So obviously the in the one we're looking at, the italic headings are added by the translator. But a Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son is part of the scriptures. Okay? This is where our verse numbers are unhelpful. Okay? If you go back to the verse numbers in the Hebrew, verse 1 of Psalm 3 is a Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. Okay? So it's part of the Psalm. What's that saying to us? It's saying to us that when we get these historical settings, they are significant to understanding the psalm. Okay? Does that mean that we sing them? Well, they are musical directions, aren't they? So presumably, when they sang this in the temple or wherever, they started, O Lord, how many are my foes? I don't imagine that they sang the first bit. Because it's not part of the poetical, but it's part of the scriptures. And if they were listen, they presumably sang it and also treated it as scripture. So if they were reading it or reflecting on it, then the Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son becomes very important to interpretation.
So your equivalent for a translated Psalm 3 in the temple, your equivalent would go out and say a Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son, then the music would strike out.
Yeah. Lord. Yeah. But I probably wouldn't. If we were just singing it, I probably wouldn't. But if I was preaching it,
no,
I would.
You were in the temple
today, yeah.
So
yeah, maybe, yeah.
That would be communicated by the musicians.
Maybe. Don't know. It's really impossible to know.
It's quite interesting that my relatively more editorial footnotes say, oh my God, it's distinct from a Psalm of David.
Save me, oh my God.
What I'm saying is there's a distinction between a relatively modern Save me, oh my God, and
Yeah. Yeah, so the same. So if I was, I do try and do this every so often, but not always take the notice. I generally encourage people when they read, do a reading in church, not to read the title. Because it's not there, it's not in the scriptures. Don't need that there. I mean, it's useful for finding your place. Don't have a problem with them being there, but they're not. So, but I would like people to read out a Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son, because that is in the scriptures. So let's read the scriptures. Let's read what's there. It gets dropped because it's not got a verse number to it, so it looks in there like it's just additional information that someone's added later. No, it's part of the original text. Book 1 is part of the original text as well, by the way. Book 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the Psalms are part of the divisions in the Masoretic text. Okay, so those are worth thinking about in terms of how the Psalms are structured as well. Good. I told you we spend a lot of time in Psalms. I wanted to do this. What does poetry do? Here's a good thing. Here's what does poetry do. Okay. So the question, one way of asking this question is to say, okay, why doesn't David just write a little bit in his diary that says, do you know what, when I was fleeing from Absalom, I really felt like I was on my own. It was a really hard time. And, what I did in the end is I prayed, cried out to God, and he comforted me. It really felt. And so when I woke up the following morning, I felt much better. Okay? Which is basic rough summary of Psalm 3. It's fine, that, isn't it? Why not just say that? Somebody's thinking, well, why not just say that? Because the psalm, the poetry, is effective language, isn't it? Which allows us to identify with the author and therefore more easily make his words our words. That's one of the functions of poetry. So this is deliberately written. Yes, of course it's David saying, O Lord, how many are my foes? But it also can very easily become the cry of the believer through time. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. Across the 3,000 years since that's been written, God's people have been able to identify with those words in very different settings to the one that David was in. Because that's the function of poetry. That's what poetry is supposed to do. It's a more immersive form. It's a more memorable form. Okay, it's effective language designed to, all languages designed to speak to the head and the heart, but it's designed to touch the heart as much as it touches the head. The balance between head and heart touching is greater from a piece of poetry. Okay. So, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, literally. No, metaphorically, okay? My glory in the lift of my head, literally? No, metaphorically. I cried aloud to the Lord, literally, and he answered me from his holy hill. Literally? Probably not. But, you see, we take it for granted, don't we? There's a lot less, there's a lot more metaphorical language in Psalms, okay? Which, of course, means you have to read them differently. You're not going to. It sounds trite and silly, but it still happens. The kind of thing, you're not going to read Psalm 3 and think, okay, next time I draw a picture of God, he needs to have a shield, because I know that he was a shield around David. You know, that's not how language like that works, is it? So let's treat it. Treat it properly. Treat it as the language that it is. Okay? Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek, you break the teeth of the wicked. I mean, given that David was in battle quite a lot, there probably were a few bits of teeth broken. But what's the point there? The point, surely, is that, you know, the teeth, one, we've got the parallelism with striking all my enemies on the cheek, so don't miss that. It's basically the same place, isn't it? Just slightly to the left or right. And it's about reducing their power, isn't it? It's about stopping them being effective. It's about, you know. So it's effective language, it's metaphorical language. Okay? Happy? Okay. I'll labour that point just because I think when we read the Psalms, we have to. I don't want to put this. We have to allow them to impact on us without so quickly moving to discerning meaning, so that we miss the effect of them. Okay? So if you're reading Psalm 3, you're not primarily reading it to find out what happened when David fled from Absalom. You're reading it to understand the experience of the righteous sufferer and how his experience relates to ours. Because the other thing to say about the Psalms of David in the Psalms is that that's generally how David functions. There's a discussion as to whether a psalm that says to David is written by David or not. There's clearly psalms that are. So a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son, well, that's clearly David literally wrote that. It only makes sense if it's David who wrote that. But there are other psalms that just say a psalm of David. And literally what that often says in the text is to David. Now, does to David mean David wrote this? Could do. I've no problem if it does, but I'm happy with someone who would say it doesn't necessarily mean that. It might mean a psalm according to the pattern of David's psalms. And according to the pattern of David's psalms, I think means the presumption of a Davidic psalm is that the psalmist is writing as the righteous sufferer, as the one whose relationship with God is fundamentally okay, and who is therefore trying to understand how to deal with the world as the righteous sufferer. Does that make sense? So that even if it's not literally David doing it, we're identifying with the Davidic figure. So David in Psalm 3 is the righteous one. Don't forget, righteous, not a claim to perfection, but a claim to be in a right relationship with God. Now, interestingly, even when you get to the Psalms of Confession, Psalm 51, famously, you know, David's confession with the whole Uriah Bathsheba thing, there's still a sense that, but certainly back by the end of that psalm, he's back being the righteous one again, because he's restored his relationship with God, or God has restored his relationship. Good, this is a fun discussion, I'm enjoying this. Some of it's written down as well. Right, different kinds of psalm, and I've just given you a list. You can make this list as long or as short as you like, okay? There are wisdom psalms. Psalm 1, how to live as God's people. We've read Psalm 1, we can see that. Blessed are those who, not so the wicked. Okay? That is wisdom, isn't it? How to live. Come on. If, you know, think about it. If you don't want to be affected by bad people, don't spend all your time hanging around with them, you moron. Psalm 1, isn't it? Well, isn't it? Okay. Salah. Yeah. And you know, being wise, I mean, and then the other side, it walk in the way of the righteous, and that will yield its fruit in season. Because there's something about patience in that as well, isn't there? You know, the what's ephemeral, the chaff versus what's permanent. If you start taking Psalm 1 apart, which you're entitled to do, then you will learn lots of wisdom. And again, notice that in a sense, Psalm 1 is a less affective language. It doesn't move you in the same way that Psalm 3 moves you. It moves you in a different way. It's supposed to. Okay. Right, royal enthronement for slams. So I correct about half of them, but I miss some of them. Psalm 2. So here's the famous one. So you know Psalm 2, the whole, why do the nations rage? He who's in heaven laughs. And then verse 7, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you're my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, that psalm is clearly a royal psalm. It's about a king. In this case, it's about the son. It's about the one who will be installed. It's about the one who will rule over other kings. Of course, from the New Testament perspective, we fully understand that to be speaking about Jesus. Okay? In the Old Testament, of course, the Lord's anointed, there's something about David and Solomon there, isn't there? There's something about the kings of Israel could at least partially fulfill this psalm. We see it fully fulfilled in Christ. And that's the kind of pattern you see in the royal psalms. You see that God is the king, but you also have an anointed human king as well. You have the relationship between those two figures being discussed in various ways. Sometimes you have an emphasis more on how this is fulfilled in Israel. Sometimes you get something like Psalm 2, which is much more looking forward. A little bit like we saw with the prophets. Some of it's, sometimes the focus is more immediate, sometimes the focus is further away. Okay? Happy? But just that's what they are. They're a different kind of psalm. They're messianic, we would take them as, wouldn't we, really, ultimately. You get psalms of praise. So let me flip to Psalm 100 for a very famous one. Make a joyful noise to the Lord. Interesting, sorry. A psalm for giving thanks. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us and we are his. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him. Bless his name. For the Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever. And his faithfulness to all generations. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's clearly a psalm that you would... It sounds like that's a psalm that you might sing on the way into the temple. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Literally, enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. But of course it becomes something which God's people throughout the ages have used metaphorically to come into God's presence. It's a great way to start a Sunday morning. We do fairly often, deliberately. Because it's a bidding, isn't it? It bids us to come into the Lord's presence joyfully to praise him. And there's plenty of praise psalms. That's not Psalm 113, 117. It should be a comma there. Okay. Yeah. 118, 118. Right. Prayer and lament. Well, we've looked at Psalm 3. Prayer and lament overlap. Sometimes we see more emphasis on the answer being received. I think it's Psalm 88, is it? There is one or two psalms of pure lament where you don't get any resolution. Yeah, Psalm 88 is like that. Last verse is, "You've caused my beloved and my friend to shun me, my companions have become darkness." So there's no resolution there, or there's no resolution within the psalm, and that can obviously, that does freak people out sometimes. But these are a prayer book for us, aren't they? So there are times when that is, as Emma says, an entirely appropriate psalm to pray, because that's where you are at the moment. Okay. So prayer and lament, confession. Yeah, obviously there's a few of them. There's perhaps less of them than you might think. Interestingly. But Psalm 51 is the classic. Again, to the choir master, a psalm of David when Nathan the prophet went into him after he'd gone into Bathsheba. Ah, yes. So that's a psalm of confession. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. But I want to say to you that still David is the righteous one who does what righteous ones do when they sin, which is come before God in confession. So he's still modelling for us what it means to be the righteous one. Vengeance, compassion, justice, they're all overlap. Let's look at 137. I used to play a game with some of the kids when the evening service, 4:30 service at my last place, and it was, you know, it's very sort of relaxed to start with. I always used to read a bit of a psalm. So I sort of play a game with the kids and say, I'll pick a number between 1 and 150. And they didn't, for a while, they didn't realise. And then they cut and done, and they kept saying 137. Which starts so promisingly, doesn't it? By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, whatever they sounded like. From there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing to us one of the songs of Zion. I don't remember the rest of this in the Bonian one. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, lay it bare, down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to be destroyed. Blessed shall he be who repays you with what you've done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. You can see why I've read that out to you, because it's challenging, isn't it? But it's ultimately a song of vengeance. It lists the oppressions that God's people have suffered and asks God to act justly in slightly more graphic language than we would use. But think about it. Every time we pray rightly that the plans of the wicked would be thwarted, how is that actually going to happen? Who is going to thwart them, and what might the mechanism be? It might actually be something akin to what we see at the end of Psalm 137, mightn't it? Just mean we tend not to specify the mechanism. But when we, you know, when we pray, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your will be done, your kingdom come, we are essentially praying the same kind of thing, just with less specificity. So just be aware of that. That's, you know, justice requires judgment. God's judgment is always just. But those who have oppressed God's people, the Edomites and the Babylonians, will be judged. I didn't intend to use that psalm particularly as an opening worship psalm, because it required too much explanation. You couldn't just say, right, Psalm 137, right, let's sing. Yeah, that's right. I think that is the original tune. I'm pretty confident that is, yeah. So there we go. Comments? I'm not going to attempt to sing it, because it'll go on tape and it'll be used again. It'll be used against me in the future. Okay. Anybody want to sort of comment on that? Okay. Assurance. Psalm 23. Famously. I've tried to pick the ones you'll know. And you'll see here that I've only given you some examples. The Lord's my shepherd, I shall not want, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, there's a psalm of assurance, isn't it? David basically speaks and says, look, this is what God's like. It is a different feel from the psalm of lament, from the prayer, because we're not identifying there any particular moment in David's life which is challenging. We're recognising, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, that there are challenging times in life. But we're not necessarily saying that they're right now. It's just, this is what God is like. Look, why Psalm 23 is one of the easiest psalms to appropriate today. There's no historical setting that you need. The imagery is pretty universal. Pretty much everybody gets sheep. Okay? And water and green pastures and houses and tables, okay? They're not culturally bound symbols, are they? And therefore, yeah, of course this is a psalm that we relate to and sing. The Lord's my shepherd, I shall not be in want. In pastures green, he leadeth me, and so on and so forth. Good. And then God's place. So this is a sort of slightly odd category. Just psalms that really focus on Zion, okay? The place where God is, the temple, which of course is at one and the same time physically a place, but also, as we go through the Psalms, a little bit more about God dwelling in the heavens and so on and so forth. And God is our dwelling place. That's Psalm 9, isn't it? Well, I had 1:2:2, I'm not sure. I was glad when they... Sorry, A Song of Ascents of David. Now, just on the comment on that title, what does that mean? When David wrote it, was it a song of ascent? Possibly. So maybe here we're seeing there's some Psalms of Ascent that were written by David and then others added to them. Don't know. I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord. Our feet have been standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem built as a city that is bound firmly together, to which the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, as was decreed for Israel, to give thanks to the name of the Lord. Their thrones for judgments were set, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they be secure who love you. Pray, peace be within your walls and security within your towers. For my brothers and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good." Now, interestingly, if I was going to argue that saying of David doesn't necessarily mean written by David, but according to David, this might be a psalm I'd go to, because the thrones for the judgment were set, the thrones of the house of David, sounds a little bit like something written later in reflection, doesn't it, to be honest? So if I was going to argue strongly for that, maybe I'd go here. I'm fairly indifferent to that, as you can tell. Either way, I don't mind. But that's a psalm about coming into God's house, isn't it? That's a psalm about God's place. So you get the sort of very literal ones, which are about the temple, and then you get the other ones, more metaphorical, about God as our dwelling place. Look, I could add to that list. You could cut that up slightly different ways. I'm just trying to give you a bit of a flavour of the different kinds of psalms that you come across. And of course, as you can see from that, and this can be sort of slightly unnerving if you're reading them in sequence, you can read Psalm 2. Well, imagine you read the start of the book. You read Psalm 1, wisdom psalm, different feel. You then read Psalm 2, messianic psalm, different feel. You then read Psalm 3, prayer, and that's a different feel again. And actually, to read three like that, that's not actually going to be easy, is it? They're much better sort of read in shorter chunks. Good. Right, we're going to have coffee in a minute, but let me just pull this. Where is this going? So, great. We've had, hopefully, greater appreciation for the Psalms. Thinking about this in terms of our prophet, the priest, and king. There's just something here about God speaking to us through his word and the enduring speaking of the Psalms, calling us to live, living for him. There's a consistency about what it means to live as God's righteous one from David all the way through the historical period and into the exile and beyond. There's a continuity of the relationship, isn't there? So, you know, if you're in Israel in 400 BC and you're being ruled by Persians and, you know, it's the day of small things, nevertheless, you can still sing Psalm 23 and you can still read Psalm 3 and there can still be you. And it's the same today, isn't it? The Psalms emphasise the continuing application of God's word to a new generation in terms of their accessibility. And of course, because these Psalms are dealing with things like Psalm 2, or predicting the future, there's nevertheless still that thread of, right, this is what God's going to do. You know, we don't just get in the Psalms this sort of effective language of here's how we relate to God. We are also being taught some stuff as well. So that comes through. That's the kind of prophet. Priest, well, there's a little bit about priests, isn't there? Psalm 110, most famously. So two verses to pull out here. First, verse 1, a psalm of David. "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." Jesus, that's one of the verses that Jesus bamboozles the Pharisees with in the Gospels, to say, who's the Lord that's not the Lord, but is David's Lord? Who is this third figure? The Lord says to my Lord. Who's David's Lord? Well, the implication, of course, is that it's Jesus, isn't it? But it's just interesting that Jesus says, well, who is that then? Who is this figure? But then later on, Psalm 110, verse 4, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Which, obviously, that everything slots into place then, doesn't it? But that, of course, is picked up in Hebrews, isn't it? Where the author of Hebrews explains how Jesus' priestly order, despite not being from the tribe of Levi, his priestly order is the order of Melchizedek, which predates Levi, and therefore this is how Jesus is a priest. Okay? And the reference to that, the only reference that you get to Melchizedek between Genesis 14 and Hebrews is Psalm 110. So it's just a little bit of advancing the story there in terms of the priest that's going to come. Do you remember last week we were talking about how that's the sort of servant songs and how this idea of the suffering servant starts to come into what it means for God's anointed to come? But as we see in the Gospels, that's not terribly integrated in first century Judaism. You know, the disciples haven't got suffering servant in their vocabulary as what the Messiah will be like. I think it's the same with this kind of priesthood stuff, this stuff about Melchizedek. It's not really forefront of anybody's heads in the first century about how this is all going to be, but it's part of the narrative of what the one who is to come is and who he's going to be. Who is the Lord that is David's Lord? Because that's another snag, isn't it? That the son of David is also ultimately the Lord of David. And how do you reconcile that? Well, you have to get to the New Testament story for that. Okay. Question? I think I've overcomplicated that, sorry. And then King, what we talked about, that Royal Psalms pointing to Jesus. Right, questions? Is that helpful? Yes. About Psalms? Yeah, go on, Chris, you've got a question.
Why is book one under there? Is there book two?
Yeah, there's five books. So book one is Psalms 1 to 41. Book two is Psalms 42 to about 72. Book three, 73 to about 87-ish? No, 89. And book four is 90 to 106, I think. And then book five is a long book. Maybe it's 105, I don't know. They're an odd length. The first and the last are... What is it? Oh, 107 maybe? Book five. You can... So this is again another suggestion that these things have come together. You can detect certain patterns within them. So book one, which is Psalms 1 to 41, is mostly Psalms of David. Psalms 3 to 41 are all Psalms of David. So that, yeah, okay, that makes sense as a collection. The songs of, let me go back to the front sheet. The songs of ascent are in the final book. Songs of Asaph, they begin a book. So book three, which is 73 to 89. Psalm 73 to 83 are Psalms of Asaph. So that looks like a collection that existed and has had a few things added to it. And then you get some of the Korahite Psalms in there, 84 to 88. So you're thinking, okay, this looks promising. Asaph. So then you've kind of got, why have you got Psalm 86, the Psalm of David in there? And then it finishes with the Maskil of Ethan the Ezraite, because no one knew else to put that. No, I'm not being funny. I mean, it's like that's kind of Psalms not written. That is a book of Psalms not written by David. Apart from one in the middle, for some reason. So, all I'm saying there is there's clearly a structure, but our capacity to fully recover it is, let's just be a bit cautious. We can see some patterns we can see, but we can't, you know, we can see the structure, there's order, but we have to acknowledge that we can't always absolutely get at the structure and order. And therefore, be wary of neat explanations when things aren't neat. Good. Are we ready for a brew?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Good questions. Let's have a cup of tea. I'll have a pause. Right, so let's have a look at the book of Proverbs. So obviously Proverbs is the most obviously wisdomy of the wisdom books, because it's about being wise, isn't it? It starts off Proverbs 1 to 9, the path of wisdom and the path of folly. Now, Proverbs 1 to 9 is quite a different feel to the rest of Proverbs. It's quite a varied book. So in the first nine chapters you get these sort of narrative, if you like. There's a narrative thread about the wisdom and folly, both being pictured as women, and which will you which will you follow? So similar kind of stuff to Psalm 1, really, but just, you know, extended. And the purpose of wisdom, verses 1 to 7 of Proverbs 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight. To receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice and equity. To give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and the riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So it's instruction for those who will hear. I drew a distinction between law and instruction, because instruction is the practical way in which you live before God, obeying the law. So Proverbs 1:1-7 has that, and then we can look in Proverbs 6 just to get a bit of a flavour. So there's warnings against adultery in chapter 6, verses 20. My son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. So that's another a pattern of parental teaching. Bind them on your heart, always tie them around your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you wake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline in the way of life, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, and do not let her catch you with her eyelashes. For the price of a prostitute is only a loaf of bread, but a married woman hunts down a precious life. Can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Or can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes into his neighbour's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. People do not desire a thief if he steals to do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his appetite when he is hungry. But if he is caught, he will pay sevenfold. He will give all the goods of his house. He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. He will get wounds and dishonour, and his disgrace will not be wiped out. For jealousy makes a man furious, and he will not spare when he takes revenge. He will accept no compensation. He will refuse though you multiply gifts. Now, what's happening here is that in the Ten Commandments it says, rightly, thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay? In the law, you get instructions for what you do to punish adultery, to find out. In the Proverbs, you get the reflection on why it's generally a good idea to avoid adultery. What the consequences will be if you commit it, and all those other kind of factors. Okay, so you can see there, it's instructions like, be wise. So it's not that the prohibition is being denied, but you're explaining the purpose behind the prohibition and why it's such a problem. Let's just give you that as an example. That's one of the things that you get in Proverbs, one of the ways in which wisdom works. And that sense of folly, he who commits adultery lacks sense, he who does it destroys himself. So all these kind of reflections on the behaviour that we're talking about. Okay, so I just want to give you that. So that's Proverbs 1 to 9. And then we get Proverbs 10. And this is where we get into the bit of the Proverbs that one level is kind of quite nice. Because you get all these sort of Proverbs, what we think of as Proverbs, the sort of single liners. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. And so on and so on and so on. And you can see, by the way, as you flick through these, that there are no headings. There are no headings, because no one quite knew what to put as the heading, basically. That's why. So you get page after page after page with the heading of the Proverbs of Solomon. Okay? Because their structure is alien to us again. They're individual proverbs, and whilst there are connections between them and whilst you can see threads that go through them, they don't work in ways that we're familiar with. Okay? You can see the purpose. The purpose comes up again and again. An example in chapter 15, verse 16 to 17. So, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fattened ox and hatred with it. Okay? So this is about the good life, which is the good life lived before the Lord. And it's wisdom. So again, you've got you think about the number of things that you've brought in those verses in terms of riches and poverty, in terms of love and hatred, in terms of all these different ways of how you put life together and what's better, what's the right way to live. Obviously, some of that's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because many would say better a lot. But Solomon's Proverbs say better a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. So what's of most value? So you can see where they're all going. And then you kind of get this idea of reflecting wisdom. So you get twice told Proverbs. That is, you get Proverbs that come up again in the book, but with slightly different nuances to them. So chapter 11, verse 13. Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a thing covered. Okay? Yeah, makes perfect sense. And then chapter 20, verse 19. Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with a simple babbler. So really interesting there, isn't it? You've got the same first half, but two complementary applications. Okay? The first, the importance of keeping it covered, keeping a secret. The second, the danger of associating with a babbler. So they're both perfectly reasonable applications of the point, aren't they? But they're just slightly different. Give you another example, 10:15. A rich man's wealth is his strong city, the poverty of the poor is their ruin. Okay, all very straightforward, verse 18:11. A rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his imagination. So what's the proverb saying? Saying, yes, okay, fair enough. It is better to be rich than poor. Okay, yeah, I get that. You know? That's chapter 10, verse 15, isn't it? The poverty of the poor is their ruin. Poverty is not great. However, a rich man's wealth is a strong city and like a high wall in his imagination. Be careful, because riches will... You will think that they're doing something that they can't do. So... let's just acknowledge this is an alien method of teaching to us. Okay, this is not how we do it. We structure things in our own way. This works differently. It's by reflecting on wisdom, and then every so often you get bits that are okay with us because they're discursive. So I'll read you chapter 10, verses 1 to 5. Again, it's not quite how we would do it, but we can. I've given you them on the sheet, but listen for those words, wisdom, wealth. Listen for the references to wisdom, wealth, diligence, righteousness, and Yahweh, and see how they overlap. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but the righteous delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. A slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame. So what you can trace through those proverbs, you've got these kind of five ideas: wisdom, wealth, diligence, righteousness, and God. And, you know, the first one, you can see there's a reference to wisdom. Isn't there? The second one, you can see there's a reference to wealth and righteousness. Okay. The third one, you can see there's a reference to righteousness and also to wealth again, probably more to what God is doing. And then you get diligence in verse 4. It's possibly in verse 3 as well. Slackness, hand of the diligent makes rich, and wealth again. And then in verse 5, you've got prudence, diligence, and you're back to the sons again, aren't you? And shame righteousness and wickedness. And so you've kind of got the... It's a bit of a thread. It's not quite as obvious as we'd like, perhaps. It's not quite how we'd put it. But it's kind of... reflecting on the same set of ideas. You're staying in the same kind of area, aren't you? Even though you're not necessarily doing it in the kind of order we would prefer it to be done in. Because what we'd like to go through and do with Proverbs, go through all the Proverbs that mention a particular setting and put them all together. Okay, and look, that's the preacher's temptation when you're preaching Proverbs, is just to... one of the reasons I haven't preached Proverbs yet is because I want to resist that temptation, but I don't know what else to do with it. So we'll preach 1-9 and then I'll work out what to do with the rest. But it's got to be like this for a reason. It's got to be like this for a reason. So we have to bend ourselves to work out why it's like this, rather than to bend it to conform to how we'd like it to be. Anyway, let's just have a quick look at 15. Maybe that's the best example. It is. That's the other thing about it. You're right. It's very, very accessible, isn't it? So I think that's one of the things that's going. You've got the surface accessibility, but there's also some other more subtle stuff going on underneath that affects in a different way. Yeah.
It's kind of very rich, isn't it?
Yes.
Read a few verses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. Yes, it's a bit like the Psalms, isn't it? It's not. You know, you've got to read it differently. I mean, You can't read three chapters at a time like you can with a narrative.
But I mean, the Psalms to me are more difficult to understand than what Proverbs are.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So you do get some nice, neat bits. A soft answer. This is chapter 15. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of fools pour out folly. Oh, okay. We can cope with that. And then you keeps going on about the tongue. So you do get bits where you can see a nice theme, tongue, lips, speaking. That's okay. Cope with that. But there are bits where the connections between the Proverbs are not as accessible to us. But you get these patterns. I'm looking forward to working it out and trying to work it out.
It's quite interesting how many you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not necessarily in a strict or scriptural context, but kind of
got yeah. 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 Not just the one about the nagging wife being like a dripping tap and stuff like that. Better the corner of the roof than a house shared with the nagging wife. That's the other one.
That's where he watches the problem with Weststone.
Okay.
So 1618.
Yeah, yeah.
Right goes before destruction.
Yeah, so you can see that. So again, that's a classic. Pride goes before destruction. We talk that about pride comes before a fall. Why? Well, because we don't do the parallelism, do we? Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall is basically saying the same thing. And so we condense that to pride comes before a fall. That's not unreasonable, but you do miss something about the poetic connection, don't you?
Well, that's not only in a church connection.
No, because it's wisdom. Because wisdom is wisdom, isn't it? So some of this is just, it's all written in the context of the fear of the Lord, but a lot of it is applicable in any context.
So there's a subtlety between wisdom and knowledge. You know that 2 + 2 = 4. That's knowledge.
Yeah, I think we can legitimately make that distinction, although I'm not sure you could make it from the distinction from the way wisdom and knowledge is used here, but for us it's helpful to think in terms of, yes, knowledge in terms of the, yes, 2 + 2 = 4. Yeah, but there's the wisdom, to stick with maths, the wisdom is to understand which bits apply when, and when is this the relevant thing to be doing, because there's a whole lot of, you know, there's a whole lot of mathematical techniques you can use, aren't there, to but your wisdom is knowing what to do when.
Yes, that's what I've got to say.
And that's the, so there's the classic
also,
in there.
But that's also that's knowledge. Knowledge.
But you've got to know what to do, but you've also got to know when to do it.
Yeah.
And if you want it simple, knowledge is knowing what to do. Wisdom is knowing when to do it. So there's a classic, isn't there? You know, there's two proverbs in there. I don't know why I didn't pull them out, I usually do. You know, answer a fool according to his folly. Don't answer a fool according to his folly. Well, which shall I do? Well, it depends. There's clearly a time for saying nothing, and there's clearly a time for saying something. But yeah, there's good for reflection. The rest of Proverbs functions in a similar way to chapters 10 to 22, so... It's a good book. I'm not sure I've worked out the way to read it. It's probably a few verses a day, really, isn't it? But
well, a lot of people read it a chapter a day a month.
Yeah, I still think that's a lot. I think it was fine for the first 9 chapters.
Yeah, well, if it says something that you know you're prone to, you just give over.
Yeah, maybe that's my concern.
I think it does work on maps. It's the sort of thing that you ladder on when it's in kids.
Yeah, it has an effective quality, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's like trying to read a book with quotation.
A little bit, although it's better than that because there is a structure to it, even if, and I think sometimes there's the effective quality of it that it does stuff, even if you're not quite sure what it's doing. That it builds you in these antitheses that cause you to be a bit more reflective about wisdom and you know, about wisdom and folly, about wealth and poverty, and about, because it doesn't allow you to say it doesn't allow you to give a simple answer that wealth is good, and it doesn't allow you to give a simple answer that wealth is bad. So it avoids that simplistic, as long as you do good, everything's fine. But it also avoids the simplistic, you know, wealth is always a good thing, wealth is always a bad thing. Well, it's a thing. And that's quite helpful, isn't it? You know, like, you know, it interests me sometimes in our current political debate that there is, it's schizophrenic, but one of the themes is the sort of tax the rich because they're rich. And you're like, well, okay, maybe we should, but I think you need a little bit more than tax the rich because they're rich. I think you actually need to think about that a bit. I think I need a better explanation than that as to why they ought to be taxed. Not just they've got lots of money, let's take it off them. Okay, well, you know, I'm not me saying I'm against taxing the rich, but I want a better reasoning than that.
Yeah.
Because that reasoning just assumes wealth is bad. So it needs to be redistributed. You think, hang on, when did we... Yeah, well, when did we go back to 1917? I mean, what does it mean? When we just moved 3,000 miles east? So, I just avoiding simplistic answers is part of, isn't it, really? Good. So Proverbs is fun. Let's have a quick look at Job, because this brings us into sort of the other thing that wisdom does, and we've started to touch on this. It's just, here's the reality, here's the problem of wisdom. Start with Psalm 1 again. Psalm 1 says, blessed is the one who does not walk in the way of wicked, stand in the way of scoffers, sit with the blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, he's like a tree planted by wisdom. Sorry, and then you come to the book of Job, and you have a problem, don't you? Job is in the wrong place. It's at the beginning of the book of... It's at the beginning of the wisdom books.
It's a nice, easy preface to Psalms.
It's a nice, easy preface to Psalms, exactly, yes. It should be... It feels like it should be after Psalms and Proverbs, because that would be easier to manage. Okay? I suspect it's possibly there because it's partly a narrative. Not sure. So, the the problem of wisdom and how life works out. What is the issue with Job? One of the big issues is the suffering of the righteous. Okay? And the way that if you live rightly, whilst in general terms it is the good way to live and works well, it doesn't always work like that. And that's what Job explores. So we get the setting. You can look at that Job 7:17 and Psalm 8 reference, just in terms of reflections on the same idea. I've given you the structure, Job. There's an introduction, there's speech cycles. Elihu speaks, God speaks, and there's an epilogue. And in that, you get the kind of trite answers. So Job has a problem. We know that this has all happened because God has allowed Satan to take his wealth and his everything from him to see what will happen. Job doesn't know that. His friends don't know that. So they're trying to say, well, why is Job suffering? And so the answer they basically give is, well, he must have deserved it. He must have done something wrong. That is the basic answer, because they are very rigidly applying the righteous prosper, the wicked suffer in this life. And as we go through Job, we see it's more complicated than that. Okay, there's a lot more to be said about Job, but that is one of the things that's happening. So what does Job teach? Okay, it teaches the hiddenness of order. We can't always see the whole picture. The paradox of Job is that we can see the whole picture, but we know that Job can't. So once we get into the narrative with him, we know that he doesn't know why it's happening, even though we do, and his friends don't know why it's happening, so they're all trying to muddle together for an answer. Okay? The answer ultimately is trust God. The search for wisdom resists trite answers. That's really important, isn't it? It is. Wisdom is not simple. If you take wisdom, as we said it, as a knowing, you know what I mean? Think about it. Look. Let's take grief, okay? When someone dies, there are various truths that we might want to communicate to that person. Yeah? To the bereaved. There is wisdom in understanding if and when those truths can be communicated. It doesn't stop them being true, but there is practical wisdom in when you say things and how things are received. So that's one way wisdom is complicated. The other thing is sometimes situations are complicated, aren't they? And it's not always straightforward. And given that order isn't always easy to read off the page, it's not always obvious why something's happened. Okay? You know. Why did this happen to this person? I don't know. Can't give you a simple answer. Not going to say, well, because they were particularly naughty. It's not necessarily the case. So we just resist that sort of easy answer. Okay. You know, what's the easy answer? I think the easy answer is saying something which is true but insufficient. So, you know, someone comes and says, look, I'm really struggling with this, this, and this. And you say to them, well, look, you know, pray about it and I'm sure it'll all be fine. Now, if they've resisted hitting you, well done them. But really, that's not a sufficient answer at that point, is it? Okay. It is true that it will be of ultimate benefit them to bring this before the Lord. They may already have done so, by the way, and to pray about it. But it's not a sufficient answer at that moment, is it? It's a trite answer. If someone comes to you, then they want you to listen, not to tell them to go away and bother God with it, not you. Now, I'm not saying that the intention of someone saying pray about it and it'll all be all right is that, but the net effect is to say, I'm not really obligated to bother God with it, not me. So I'm just trying to give you an example of what I mean by not being trite. Our knowledge of God is limited by what God chooses to reveal. That's an important lesson for us, isn't it? Okay, we don't have total knowledge of God's purposes. If wisdom is the fear of the Lord, then one of the things that Job teaches us is about the greatness of God, particularly those latter chapters about God's sovereignty over all things, you know, God's power over Leviathan and Behemoth and all these other things. This is all about, precisely how you read those, this is all about God as the one who is sovereign. You know, and if the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Job really starts to tell us why. And then I suppose the whole thing with Leviathan at the end and Satan at the beginning is just, you know, don't forget there's a spiritual struggle going on here. The stuff that we read about in Ephesians 6, you know, putting on the armour of God, there's a real issue. There's a real spiritual battle. Don't forget that. Don't make this very kind of mundane and earthly. As if righteousness plus diligence equals wealth was as easy as 2 + 2 = 4. There are other factors in the equation that make that less. There's lots more to say about Job, but that's that's sufficient. Where is it leading us to? It's one of the more challenging books for saying, "All right, this is how this points us to Christ." There are patterns that we can see. There is discussion of the calling out for the Redeemer and the need for Redeemer comes, isn't there? You know, I know that my Redeemer lives. So there's that stuff. But yeah, okay. Any questions on Job? We've really skirted on that. Just wanted to give you a bit of a flavour. It's just understanding how it functions as a wisdom. It sort of it accepts that there's a complication.
When you first read it, it does seem very unfair that Job has done all this and then sort of one thing against God and God goes.
But that's not why God. That's not why what happens to God, what happens to Job, happens in the first place. Do you mean at the end?
Yeah, at the end when he sort of says. Why?
Yeah, well, it's not the first, not the only time it says it, though, is it?
I don't know. It just feels like it's a whole
thing
about God slamming the
room. I think let's read it more as a response to all of what Job says. Okay. I mean, Job's nowhere near as culpable as his friends. But yes, it is. But then,
actually,
it's working that out, isn't it?
When God says to him, "Where were you when they were born?" And I think all he's doing, I hear God saying that very calmly, and what he's doing is changing Job's perspective.
Yeah.
It does work brilliantly in a lot of different tones of voice. It's an amazing.
Yeah, but no, I mean,
I should read it when I'm
wrong. It's not a straightforward book. It is a challenging book. And it doesn't, again, you know, you're left with the advisors of, well, we know them as Job's counsellors, aren't you? Job's comforters. Well, that's what, you know, that's why that's
I've heard the expression that, used.
Well, no, it is, but that's, you probably heard the expression used rightly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what they're known as, because they are their false comforters. But what they say is allowed to apparently stand. So that's the interesting thing, isn't it? They get to say all this stuff, and the narrator doesn't come in and say, "Oh, by the way, you know that's wrong, don't you?" So that's wisdom again, isn't it? Because we're left to do quite a lot of the work to think, "Hang on, why is that wrong?" Clearly, God feels He's given us enough information everywhere elsewhere for us to be able to do that. But that we are required to do a bit more working out, perhaps, than we would like sometimes. Briefly, then, I'm not going to talk on. I've given you Song of Songs and Lamentations. You'll have to read off the page. I did give slightly fuller notes, and the stuff on the back you can go and play with if you want to. So don't worry about that. I know I'm only halfway through page 3, but it's fine. Ecclesiastes, similar to Job, in the sense that it is. It is that question about wisdom, and is it really worth living like this when actually, apparently, life is meaningless? Okay? It doesn't matter whether you live well or you live badly, because it's all vanity. 1, 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Emptiness. Probably would be as good a translation, because vanity has the idea of being vain of it, doesn't it? Emptiness of emptiness, says the preacher. Emptiness of emptiness. All is empty, fruitless, meaningless, purposeless, hebel. So now the preacher is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. That may or may not be Solomon. It doesn't really. I mean, son of David. Applies to a lot of people in terms of kings. They're all sons of David, aren't they? The southern monarchs. But you've got this sort of vanity, as life is meaningless. Chapter 12, verse 8 at the end. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. Obviously, you've got chapter 1, verses 4 to 11. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. There is no, verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things. yet to be among those who come after. It's all going to, it's all passing away. It's all, what's the point? Okay? Raises that question, the apparent meaningless of life, and that's really what we go through as we go through the book. And that is the question that the book raises, and how is it answered? Well, again, similar to Job, you've got to do the working out. You've got to see the purpose through the apparent emptiness. There is a danger in vanity and emptiness. There's a danger in investing too much in that which is ephemeral. There's also a danger of unreality and wisdom, isn't there? This is the triteness again. There's no the simple answers. And I think really what you do here is you can link this book back particularly with the result of the fall, the reality of the frustration of creation, all that broken relationship stuff that we talk about from Genesis 3 onwards, does mean that there is a lot of vanity about. There's a lot of emptiness, there's a lot of fruitlessness. There's a lot of things that are apparently not worth bothering with because the outcome isn't any better, you know? So how would people put this today? They'd say, well, what's the point of me looking after my health and running every day and eating vegetables and not eating rubbish, because I might still die of a heart attack when I'm 60 anyway. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's, you've heard people say that, that kind of thing. What's the point? It's not fair, is it? You know, that person, you know, I hear people say to me, that person looked after themselves and lived and they were healthy and they still died. Yeah. There's a lot of things where we say, yes, there's an absolute, you know, there's a truth here about these, about the vanity, the emptiness of life, the apparent purposeless of life, and it is about finding the purpose in that. Of course you get the answer at the end, don't you? Besides being wise, now this is interesting, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. Quite important that we get that affirmation of the preacher, that this is wisdom that you've just read. Don't dismiss the preacher and think that the narrator says, oh no, we don't agree with that. He says, no, the preacher's right. So listen to the preacher. The words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed for the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end, and much studies awareness of the flesh. Read wisdom, like this book. At the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Two statements there. One is, what is it you're supposed to do in the midst of this? Fear God and keep his commands. And don't forget, in the end, it will all be brought into the light. So the apparent vanity of things, the apparent fruitlessness, that which is truly worthwhile, will be revealed. So there's an eschatological element about that, again, isn't there? As we've said, we've come before. On the day when God returns, all will be revealed for what it really is, that which is truly vanity, that which isn't, that which is apparently vanity, not worth doing, but wasn't, and that which was apparently worthwhile, and actually ultimately, was emptiness. So that's quite a nice way of finishing the wisdom which starts, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Because there's an ultimate trust, isn't there, that God will reveal all things in the end, everything will come to light, and therefore in the midst of all this vanity, we can live, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Live as his people, wherever you find yourself, in the midst of good times, bad times, you know, all those kind of things. In a vain world where there is much emptiness.
The one which I like in Ecclesiastes is this bit in chapter 3, at the end of the time for everything.
Yeah.
It says, he has made everything beautiful in its time.
Yeah.
So he has put eternity into man's heart.
Yes.
And I think of that as everybody sort of having a God-shaped peace inside empty to all their knowing.
Yeah. So again, it's appreciating those moments, isn't it, and those little bits that stand out and appreciating with the sort of context of what we're trying to do with wisdom. Good. Song of Solomon, Lamentations, you can have a look at, and you can have a look at the Psalms if you want to. There we are. You see, I told you it'd be fine this week. Let's finish there. Great. Thank you.